let's continue on in the text. So we're in the sixth of the 7 points, the commitments of mind training. And these are things mainly to avoid that go against mind training. So we're looking on the page 17, the top right-hand corner. We've done the first slogan up there, that transform your attitudes but remain as you are. The next one, it says, do not speak of the defects of others. This states that you should never speak of others' defects, neither their worldly defects, for instance, calling that blind person, nor their spiritual defects, for instance, by calling them the morally degenerate person. So here what we're talking about, of course, is, again, our old friend cognitive fusion, is identifying people with their behaviours, with their habits and so forth, and then attacking the person. And also, of course, here, when we do this, together with that, there's often this idea of putting ourselves in a superior position, you know, putting other people down. You know, again, this is a sort of form of self-cherishing, you know, where we boost ourselves and by putting other people down and trying to put ourselves as better person than others. Of course, there is a case for if someone has some faults to talk to them about that, but again, generally, if we speak about others' defects in public, it's just a sign that we're trying to make ourselves feel superior. But here, Alan Wallace, I think, has some good advice. So let's have a look at what he says here. We tend to indulge the habitual urge to discuss in great deal other people's faults. This aphorism reiterates the old adage, if you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. Usually discussing someone else's faults is a way to vent frustration, show contempt, and affirm one's own superiority. The more passion one has about the faults of others, the more agitated the mind becomes. Life is too short and too important to waste discussing the faults of others. This behaviour has no benefit, undermines the cultivation of bodhicitta, and ultimately hurts ourselves. There are a few exceptions. For example, a doctor may tell a patient his diagnosis out of benevolence and with an intention of curing him. Likewise, parents speak to their children about the children's problems. Among friends, there is also a responsibility to discuss shortcomings out of a spirit of altruism. When we notice a friend doing something that is harmful, something that he may not even be aware of, out of affection and concern, we have the responsibility to draw his attention to the behaviour. This is being a good friend. When the motivation is one to be of benefit, there are appropriate occasions and ways to discuss the faults of others. If the motivation is for anything other than benefit, it's best to keep silent. So I think we need to have some good advice there. And similarly, the next one is very similar. Do not reflect on others' shortcomings. It is inappropriate to ruminate about the shortcomings of sentient beings in general, and in particular of those who have entered the monastic order, especially your fellow practitioners. At the least, you should be joyful toward them, for you are training the mind. Even if you happen to feel that certain associations may be inappropriate, since you are training the mind, contemplating others' shortcomings is inappropriate. If you do happen to lose control and notice others' shortcoming, think, this is my own deluded perception. No such flaw exists in them. All sentient beings are endowed with the nucleus of Buddhahood. Reflect in this manner and judge your perception to be your own flaw. So here, of course, there's a couple of things to say. Again, usually when we're thinking about that, about others, again, it's often because we want to feel good about ourselves, so we're sort of judging others. And again, it's often with this cognitive fusion. And one interesting thing here is that, and we can check this in our own experience, is if there's a certain person that when we see them, they seem to irritate us, but they don't seem to irritate anybody else, then check. Is the behavior that they're displaying, do we actually have that behavior ourselves that, and we don't want to acknowledge it? And that's often the case, is that we often don't like to see that behavior in others because it's a mirror. It reflects something about ourselves that we don't like or we don't like to acknowledge. And so therefore we find it irritating, that behavior, because it's really showing to us that actually we have this and we need to work on it. So check, if someone is irritating you, but they don't seem to irritate anyone else, have a look at their behavior. Do we have traces of this behavior in ourselves that we don't like to acknowledge? And then, of course, here, again, we need to avoid the cognitive fusion. Otherwise, we will be thinking badly about others, rather than having compassion for others if they're behaving badly. So I'll just keep going through these, and if at any time anyone has any questions, just please raise your hands, otherwise we'll keep going.
I'm not sure, what is shortcoming?
Shortcomings is faults, faults of others.
What is the difference between defects and shortcomings?
Defects and shortcomings. Well, shortcoming can also mean just a lack of something. Like a shortcoming is a lack of generosity. A defect is something negative. A shortcoming may be means not, we don't have something of what we should have. It can also mean that.
If a person irritates a lot of people, if it's not only me getting irritated by a certain behavior, but say a huge part of a group is getting irritated, stay away?
Again, we use wisdom and compassion. If we see that their behavior is actually negative and harmful, then using wisdom and compassion, we address that. You know, if we feel that by speaking to them, they're open, that can help, then we do that. So we do whatever we can to alleviate that. So we're not saying to ignore negative behavior in others. But again, irritation is usually a sign of self-cherishing and also a sign that often their behavior is reflected in us. So, so first we can let go of that self-cherishing and then just see that that person is actually engaging in a harmful behavior and then have compassion for them and then with wisdom decide how to respond to that. Maybe we need to talk to them, maybe whatever we find is the best thing to do. Okay. Discard all expectations of reward. Discard all expectations such as respect for your mind training, material gifts, services and fame, protection against harms caused by non-humans in this and future lives, the attainment of a joyful human or celestial existence, and the attainment of nirvana. Ensure that you have no expectation even for Buddhahood for your own sake. Do not harbor impatience and excessive expectation even for the meditative qualities. For were the demons to become aware of this, they could create obstacles. Particularly here, we can talk about the inner demons. The inner demons will create obstacles for us. Our inner demons of actually expectation and impatience and so forth do create obstacles for us. Even if you were to exert strong effort with no loss of interest for a long time, but still get no results, do not become discouraged. So here, again, we need to distinguish between expectation and aspiration. So, of course, we have to set a goal. We have to know what we want to achieve. Otherwise, we have no direction. We just float around. So we have a goal. We need to know, of course, how to proceed to that goal, what methods we need to engage in to achieve that goal. And we need to aspire and put effort towards that goal. But, of course, all of that is in the present moment. Expectation is all about jumping into the future. You know, am I there yet? Am I there yet? You know, and so of course expectation is again another form of attachment, and we see this here that in the spiritual path, of course, we can become attached to achieving the goal, attached to nirvana, attached to enlightenment, attached to having some experience. Any attachment, of course, is going to block us progressing. And again, it's another sign that we're still stuck in the hope-fear cycle, hoping pleasant things, hoping for pleasant experiences, fearing or worrying about unpleasant experiences. So expectation is really going to create a lot of obstacles in our practice. So if we notice any sort of expectations, drop it, drop it, drop it. Two expectations in particular that are very common. One is expecting that simply by knowing some, having some intellectual understanding, that somehow our life will change. I had this expectation a lot when I first came. You know, I first came into a course, I did a few more courses, had a lot of new knowledge about these great ideas and so forth. And then I thought when I'd go home, my life would be completely different. Of course, it's not. I mean, intellectual knowledge is not going to automatically change your life. So if we have that expectation, we're just going to get frustrated and upset. So that's one expectation we definitely can let go of, because we're only going to change our life if we bring that intellectual knowledge into experience through practice, through meditation, integrating. Then things will start to change. And the other expectation that we often have is that we expect that our practice will go like this, that, you know, week after week it'll get improve, get better and better. I don't know anyone whose practice goes like this. In the short term, it's more like this. Because from day to day, our mind is very different. Some days it's more quiet, more calm, more focused. Some other days much more agitated, distracted, caught up in negativity. So in the short term, there are enormous fluctuations. So if we have the expectation that my meditation this week will be at least as good as last week, and I think it'll be actually a bit better. If we have that expectation, we're just going to have a lot of frustration. So have a long-term perspective, not a short-term perspective. Drop all expectations and simply work in the present moment as best we can. You know, often we have people, when people who do a bit of meditation, they talk amongst themselves and one will say to the other and they'll say, oh, I had a really good meditation this morning. My mind was very still and focused and very good. And the other, another day people say, oh, my meditation today was really bad, awful, my mind was all over the place. If this is our idea of good and bad meditation, we're still stuck in expectation, we're still stuck in hope and fear cycle, hoping for pleasant things to happen, fearing or worrying about unpleasant things to happen. So what is a good meditation then? A good meditation is simply any meditation where we, to the best of our ability, try to follow the instructions, no matter what happens. That's a good meditation. A bad meditation is simply where we sit down and we don't put any effort and try to follow the instructions. We just let the mind do whatever it wants. That's a bad meditation. Whereas if we feel that a good meditation is only when the mind is very focused and clear and so forth, we're just caught up in expectation and hope and fear. So drop all of that and work in the present moment. And whatever happens is okay. Discard poisonous food, the next slogan. I think we can anticipate what poisonous food here is, but let's read the commentary. Poisonous food is the harbouring of self-interest in the depth of your heart. Never fail to penetrate to perceive self-grasping as the enemy, or fail to let go of self-cherishing and the thoughts that grasp at the substantial reality of things. These make everything you do into a cause of cyclic existence, thus binding you even more within cyclic existence and giving rise to suffering. Since these are all like poisonous food, you must discard them. So just like if you know a certain food is poisonous, you would never eat it. Similarly, we can understand that self-grasping, self-cherishing mind are poisonous to us. They just create a lot of suffering, so we would not eat them. We would not allow them to take control of our mind. And here again, this self-cherishing is very sneaky. And it can really sneak up on us. So we really need to be alert to the self-cherishing mind. The next one also is very important, and so it's a bit difficult to interpret this slogan, the original slogan. It says, do not maintain inappropriate loyalty. And the commentary here says, this means you should not refrain from expressing condemnation out of disapproval of unjust acts committed by the other. So here, do not maintain inappropriate loyalty. Inappropriate loyalty would be loyalty or being okay with my mental afflictions and being okay with others' negative behavior. So that's inappropriate loyalty. So inappropriate loyalty would mean to be okay about our mental afflictions. You know, so my mental afflictions is okay.
To receive.
Sorry?
It's like to receive it.
No. If we have a mental affliction arising in our mind, loyalty means to... What's another word for loyalty?
To be loyal. Okay.
Yeah, to be loyal. So we don't want to be loyal to our mental afflictions. In other words... And we don't want to be loyal to other people's bad behavior. So that's inappropriate loyalty here. So it says here that we should not refrain from expressing condemnation out of disapproval for unjust acts committed by another. Means that we should show disapproval for others' bad behavior. But again, not do cognitive fusion and attack the person. But if we really believe someone is bad, behaving in a bad way, then we need to express that, of course, using wisdom and compassion appropriately, and similarly with our own mental afflictions, is not to tolerate our own mental afflictions either, and not to maintain loyalty to mental afflictions, is to not tolerate those. So this is what this point here is about. And the next one. Do not torment with malicious banter. Whatever tasks befall you, do not engage in malicious jokes that tear at others' hearts or cause them to lose their composure. Regardless of their culpability, avoid insulting or speaking harshly to others, whether close or distant, good or bad. So again, this is... generally a sign of self-cherishing, trying to put others down, and also, of course, cognitive fusion. Identifying others with their negative behavior, negative thoughts, negative emotions, and so forth. And similarly, the next one is also a classic case of cognitive fusion. Do not lie in ambush. And here, the Tibetan, I think, literally means don't wait in a narrow passage. Which is usually what we do with an ambush. We wait till we can trap them in a narrow space. Do not harbour vengeance for a wrong done to you, waiting for an opportune moment to retaliate. So again, this is a classic case of cognitive fusion. Is that someone has engaged in a harmful behavior, and in this case, they've maybe harmed us. So again, if we do cognitive fusion, then of course, often we're going to get angry, and then of course, we're going to have this idea of retaliating to them, retaliating because they're a bad person, so I need to get back at them for their harmful behavior. So again, if we avoid that cognitive fusion, then we can... avoid this sort of feeling of revenge. Rather, we should have compassion and try to help that person to overcome that negative behavior. Again, here, I think Alan Wallace has something to say about this one. So let's see.
What the meaning of the word streak?
Sorry?
What is the meaning of the word streak?
Strike, to hit. Uh-huh. Trying to find this. No, actually, it's the next one. Okay, let's move on then. Do not strike at the heart. Toward both humans and non-humans, avoid delving into their weak points. With non-humans, for instance, you should avoid uttering fierce, life-extracting mantras. And in the case of humans, you should avoid unearthing, for instance, their moral lapses in situations where many people are around. So again, it's the same idea.
Humiliate.
And again, it's a sign. It's a way of showing or putting ourselves above others. And again, it's all self-cherishing and cognitive fusion. Again, it's we're identifying them with their faults, and then we're using that to humiliate them in public. So, of course, this is not helpful. This is completely opposite to mind training. So, of course, if they have some ethical lapses, then in private, we can, with compassion, we can highlight to them how they're behaving in an unethical way and help them to try and overcome that unethical behavior. But if we're doing this, of course, in public, then generally it's through the selfish motivation, trying to make ourselves feel better than others and trying to hurt others. Do not place the load of a zo on an ox. A zo actually is a cross between... actually, it's interesting here. You know, we always talk about getting yak's cheese. You know, we talk about yak's cheese, but this is completely crazy. Because a yak is the male animal.
Yeah.
So yak's cheese is like bull's cheese. So it's actually funny when you see the word yak cheese. I mean, it's just it's actually impossible, of course, because a yak is the male of the species, and the female is actually called a dree. So it's actually dree cheese, not yak cheese.
How do you spell that?
Dree, D-R-I, dree. Sorry?
A zo is
a cross between a yak and a cow, or a cross between a bull and a dree. So the two species, either the male from either of the species, a cross. And that cross is called a zo. And a zo, because of that interbreeding, is a very strong beast of burden. It's an animal that can carry a lot of weight. So that's what it's saying here is, when it's saying, do not place the load of a zo on an ox. And the commentary here says, avoid such negative behavior as attempting by devious means to shift blame and liabilities onto others that would otherwise fall onto you. So there's two things here. There's simply passing blame onto others, but more in accordance with this don't place the load of a zo on an ox is also the idea of putting things onto others who're not able to bear it, it would be putting some responsibility onto someone, knowing that they're not going to be able to sustain it and that they will suffer because of it, and knowingly doing that. So I think this is the point here is, you know, we're trying to put some load onto someone else in the hope that they'll fail and they'll suffer. They're not able to bear it. So this is really the point here. The next one, do not sprint to win a race. Of course, this is a classic eight worldly concerns, you know, self-cherishing, me. You know, I need to be the top of the pile. I need to get the best of everything before everyone else. Avoid such behavior, attempting through unbecoming conduct and other means to transfer the ownership of commonly owned desired objects to yourself. You should not be in a state of craving when you die. And since the other shore comes into being as a result of karma anyway, it is far more joyful instead to let go with a sense of ease, the master said. So here, of course, we're talking about this self-cherishing, eight worldly concerns, seeing ourselves as the most important, my happiness more important than the others. So here, maybe read a little bit from this book about this point, Practice of Lojong. It's on page 189. Human beings are by nature competitive and constantly want to outperform other people. It really doesn't matter what we are doing. We always act as if we were in some kind of a race, which must have a winner and a loser. This slogan is a reminder that this fixation on winning, outperforming and outsmarting everyone else is a very harmful distraction. It only engenders pride and arrogance when we do a little better than someone else, and gives rise to resentment, envy and jealousy when we perform a little worse. This slogan is not saying that we shouldn't try to excel at things we do, for that would be contrary to the Mahayana vision. It's only suggesting we can excel without having to compete with others. If we want to compete, compete with ourselves to try to improve. We can attain excellence by ourselves simply by doing something to the best of our ability. Even when we are performing in an actual race, we can run the race without thinking we have to be the fastest. What's the slogan that I think we don't really follow anymore, but it's still said, is it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. I mean, we always say that, but I mean, how many people follow this advice these days? I mean, it's very sad, isn't it? It's all about winning, in fact. But they keep saying it's not whether you win or lose, it's how you play the game. I mean, it'd be good if we actually followed that advice, and that's what we're saying here. If you do manage to be the fastest, that's all very well and good, but you shouldn't enter the race with that expectation. And then there's something a little bit more... Okay. Many people actually describe their lives as some kind of race, with some people getting farther ahead and others getting left behind. From the Lojong perspective, the samsaric idea that we have to compete with others to gain ground is completely erroneous. We only obsess over winning because of the elation we experience when we have gained superiority over others and we see someone else losing. This is only an illusory victory fabricated by the samsaric mind, and we'll experience many obstacles if we continue to see things this way. There will always be people who are richer, more attractive and more intelligent than we are, with many other qualities besides, and we'll always feel like a failure in relation to them, no matter what kind of victories we have. In any case, today's winner is yesterday's loser. Life isn't a race, and there don't have to be any winners or losers, nor do we need to see someone else lagging behind in order to feel good about ourselves. This preoccupation with competition is a form of self-deception. We need to think more about what we're doing in relation to ourselves if we want to excel. The Mahayana teachings advise us to compete with our previous selves, using our past successes and failures as the measure of our progress in overcoming old constraints, fears, suspicions, and self-doubts. Reinventing ourselves in this way is in complete accord with the Mahayana teachings on self-transformation. If we're too competitive, our lives will become a never-ending battle where we squander our energies trying to outperform others. There can be no real victory in this approach. If we think in terms of excellence, on the other hand, we achieve constant victory. This Lojong commitment to non-competitiveness is about doing our best for our own sake rather than as a way of competing with others. We vow to renounce our need to compete, to compare ourselves with others or achieve any kind of worldly victories, and simply concentrate on performing our everyday activities and Lojong practices to the best of our ability. I think some very good advice there. So I'll just keep going if there's no questions. Do not abuse this practice as a right. Again, I mentioned this already and a few times, and let's go through it again. There is no qualitative difference between someone who, seeking well-being in the long term, accepts certain losses in the interim, and someone who engages in mind training as a ritual with the long-term motivation to conquer demonic harms. Therefore, avoid behavior such as this that fails to root out the jaundice of self-centeredness from its depth. Some practitioners seem to think that mind training practice is beneficial for such a result or purpose. If this is true, there is no real difference between practicing mind training and engaging in gaining in shamanistic rites. To be called Dharma practice, mind training must become an antidote to afflictions and false conceptualizations. So this is talking about using mind training as a method for simply overcoming self-cherishing and self-grasping mind, and not using these practices as some sort of ritual for some other purpose. And we see sometimes that happening, is that people use these practices as some sort of ritual to dispel others and dispel demons and so forth. And then we've really missed the point of the whole practice. And this is what's being said. So again, just maybe read a little bit from this book, what he says, Tralok Gyapkon, what he says about this point. This slogan is about the need for sincerity and honesty in our spiritual pursuits. We never use spiritual activities to further our dubious and self-centered motivations and goals. We may be doing all the right things in our Lojong practice externally, helping someone in need, showing kindness to others, or lending an ear to the tormented, but our actions lack real sincerity because we are trying to manipulate a situation to our own advantage so that we don't have to relinquish our egoistic domain. Some notion of trickery is involved here because we are trying to shortchange something or someone. Okay, maybe that's enough for that one. The next one. Do not turn the gods into demons. When displeased, the worldly gods cause harm. The gods are supposed to be beneficial in general, so if they cause harm, they have then become demons. Similarly, mind training is supposed to subdue self-grasping. Avoid, therefore, becoming inflated by its practice and generating conceited thoughts such as, I am an excellent practitioner of mind training. Others lack this spiritual practice. So again, here, this is the classic spiritual materialism, and now we're a spiritual ego. So we've turned the god of mind training into the demon of self-cherishing, spiritual ego. Avoid ridiculing and insulting others out of a sense of superiority. If practitioners strengthen their grasping at the self-existence of phenomena, their practices become an endeavor of the enemy. It becomes an act of allowing the thief to escape in the forest while looking for his footprints on a rocky mountain. Avoid all such conduct, and by disgracing to self-grasping, ensure that the medicine is applied right where the illness is. Comport yourself as the lowest of low among the servants of all sentient beings. So again, this is the whole idea of not allowing our mind training practice to turn into a demon, that not allow the ego to grab hold of mind training practice, and now we become spiritual ego, and just to boost our self-cherishing, you know, and see ourselves as superior to others, now we're doing some sort of spiritual practice, or pretending to at least. And so here, the last sentence, comport yourself as the lowest of low among the servants of all sentient beings. So again, that is reminds me of that quote that I think I've quoted once or twice already, is that the harvest of good qualities does not grow on the rocky peaks of pride. It grows in the low, fertile valleys of humility. So here again, to make sure that our mind training practice doesn't turn into this demon of self-cherishing and spiritual ego. Maybe here also, Alan Wallace, let's see, in his text. Yeah. This is what he says here. Don't bring a god down to the level of a demon. While engaging in this mind training, we are emulating the awareness and conduct of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, likened here to gods. But it is possible to reduce such practice to the level of a demon when it results in an exalted sense of self. I am special. I am holy. The notions, my Dharma is pure. My way is the only right way. I am a pure practitioner. All bring the god of Dharma down to the level of the demon of egotism. The practices of mind training are all designed as antidotes for afflictions of our own minds. That is what it is all about. And then the last of the slogans within the commitments of mind training here says the following: do not seek misery as a means to happiness. This refers to not drawing personal gratification from others' miseries. Do not, for example, harbour thoughts such as, if my spouse or this particular friend dies, their family lineage will come to an end. If the wealthy benefactor becomes ill or dies, I will have the opportunity to accumulate merit and roots of virtue. If my meditator colleague of this region dies, I alone will have the opportunity to accumulate merit. And if this enemy dies, I will enjoy happiness. The master, again, Geshe Chikawa, has said that since sentient beings experience their own individual merits, no matter where they go due to karma, you will find enemies and friends. So again, I think this is fairly straightforward. Again, this is a sign of self-cherishing. If we see other people suffer and we're happy to see them suffer, then of course the self-cherishing mind is at play. So we don't want to... if we're deriving pleasure from others' misfortunes, then of course we have self-cherishing mind plus cognitive fusion. So we avoid that cognitive fusion and really let go of the self-cherishing mind. And so of course then if we see others in some suffering condition, rather than being happy about that, we would have compassion for them and try to help them to overcome their negative behavior. So that completes the slogans for the commitments of mind training. And again, what we saw there is that they're mainly things to avoid so that our mind training practice doesn't go astray and doesn't go in the wrong direction. And again, what we saw in there is that most of them are really about this sort of spiritual ego, you know, that allowing the ego to grab hold of our practice. And of course, this is just another form of the self-cherishing mind. And then we turn our spiritual practice into one of the eight worldly concerns, where we're simply doing the spiritual practice for fame and reputation and praise and so forth. So to complete that section, just to summarize the commitments of mind training, I'll read from this book here again on page 196. The commitments of this sixth Lojong point are about arresting common human traits that are in fact quite unhelpful to us in both our spiritual practice and our everyday lives. If we fail to pay attention to them, our mind training practices will be corrupted or curtailed and we'll fail to derive any real benefit from them. We often neglect to pay sufficient attention to these traits because their familiarity and frequency seduce us into thinking they are of little real consequence. So the full virulence of their harmful effects manages to slip under our radar. From our deluded samsaric standpoint, it may seem that many of these traits are necessary for our own well-being, self-esteem, and self-worth. Talking about others' defects may make us appear more desirable, or gossiping about others' misfortunes may make our own misery seem less. But we have to examine these tendencies much more closely to see that it is a completely mistaken aspect of our lives. This Lojong point is emphasizing the fact that despite having a good motivation and the best intentions, our mind training will have little success if we can't commit ourselves strongly enough to undermining these traits. These tendencies don't bring us any self-confidence or happiness. In fact, they undermine our personal autonomy and well-being and obstruct our spiritual progress. It's important to put an end to these negative and paranoid tendencies and replace them with love, compassion, and the development of a kind heart. Kind-heartedness is one of the central premises of the Kadampa tradition, as the following anecdotal story by Patril Rinpoche illustrates. It's a very nice little point. So this Patril Rinpoche, of course, is a modern-day master, Dzogchen master. And he says in one of his texts, and he's talking about Atisha. So remember, Atisha is the great Indian master who brought this whole Lojong system to Tibet. And he says here, Atisha always placed a unique emphasis on the importance of a kind heart. And rather than ask people, how are you? He would say, has your heart been kind? Very nice. No? So that's the commitments. Any questions about any of the commitments? Then we'll keep moving on. So let's go to the seventh of the mind training points. So here, the seventh one is the precepts of mind training. And the precepts, the commitments again, were things to really avoid that sort of go against mind training, whereas precepts are more about things to that help to support and nurture our practice, that help our practice go further. So again, to introduce the seventh point, we can read a little bit from this book here, The Practice of Lojong, on page 198. The seventh and final point concerns our approach to mind training in everyday life. Unlike the prescriptive slogans of the previous point, which are binding definitions of what we should and shouldn't do, these depict the overall Lojong spirit we require in order to progress with our practices. Each slogan is meant to act as a triggering mechanism that will help us recall our intention, recall our attention to the present moment whenever we become distracted. If we treat each slogan as a mindfulness practice and memorize them properly, they will automatically spring to mind when the appropriate situations arise and make us more aware of what we are doing. So let's have a look at these slogans here. So here the seventh of the 7 points, presentation of the precepts of mind training. Since your mind training will not degenerate, but will in fact take you to progressively higher levels, you should engage in the practice of this teaching. So the first of the slogans here says, accomplish all yogas through a single means. So let's read the commentary and then some more comments. Other spiritual practices have their own particular dietary requirements, modes of conduct, and so on, and in addition to their yogic practices. For those who have entered the door of this mind training practice, it is sufficient to engage in all activities, such as those pertaining to food, solely by keeping in mind this mind training practice. You should engage in this practice. So again, here, what is the single means is bodhicitta. So we can do all of our yogas, all of our activities through the single means of bodhicitta, or the two bodhicittas, the ultimate and conventional bodhicitta. And here this word yoga, the word yoga can mean to yoke together, to yoke together, to put together two things. And in Tibetan, the word yoga is nel jaw.
What?
Nel jaw in Tibetan, the word yoga. Nel here means what is real or authentic. And jaw means to join. So yoga, coming through Tibetan, means to join to that which is real and authentic. So what we're talking about, of course, is joining or connecting with reality, because that's what's real and authentic, is reality. So yoga is practices to help us to connect with reality.
They talk about yoga, like also yoga is, the asanas and all of this?
Yes, but again, this is physical yoga.
Yeah.
But again, directly or indirectly, yoga in Buddhism is leading us to connect with reality.
And also physical.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it talks here. It says about the yoga of eating food and so forth. Yes, of course. But that's the meaning of the word yoga in Buddhism. The word yoga is to join is practices. External and internal practices to help us to join to reality, to connect with reality. And we see this actually in Tantra. In Tantra, we can talk about four levels of tantric practice. The first one is called Kriya Tantra, often called Action Tantra. And there, yoga is the practice in Kriya Tantra. There's a bigger emphasis on external yoga, meaning cleanliness of the body, eating the right sort of food and so forth, because it's easier to do this external activities than to work with the mind. So at the introductory level of Tantra, in the Kriya Tantra level of practice, there's a lot of emphasis on external yoga. And therefore, at that level, we see a lot about, you know, these black foods, not eating these foods that agitate the mind, you know, like onion, garlic, radish, and so forth. So that's where that comes from Kriya Tantra, where there's a bigger emphasis on taking care of the external things because it's easier. Then the next level from Kriya Tantra is called Charya Tantra. We can put these up. Then we have Charya Tantra, and in Charya Tantra, is translated sometimes as Performance Tantra, now there's more equal balance of emphasis on external yoga and internal yoga. Internal yoga, of course, is working with the mind. Then we have Yoga Tantra, and now there's more emphasis on inner yoga and less on external yoga. And then we have Anuttara Yoga Tantra, or often translated as Highest Yoga Tantra, and here there's a complete emphasis on inner yoga. And so generally, and so these are four levels of tantric practice. In Tibetan Buddhism, you don't really see much at these levels. More common in Tibetan Buddhism is Kriya Tantra and Highest Yoga Tantra, Anuttara Yoga Tantra. So that's a little bit of a side there on the word yoga.
I was wondering because...
Oh, and on this, when we talk about these tantric vows and doing generation completion stage practice, it's this level. Here there's no tantric vows,
yeah,
and there's no generation completion stage practice. Of course there are practices here,
mm-hmm,
but generation completion stage is here. Of course, here we can get an empowerment and do a sadhana practice, and generally it involves visualizing the deity in front and so forth. This is the level that's most commonly practiced.
So, just as an off question, when they talk about a tantric yoga, yoga in a way that, you know, more related to the sexual, you know, that there is all of this...
That's the highest level of this. Highest. But of course, there's nothing sexual about it. You know, they talk about tantric sex.
Yeah.
But that's, I think, coming from the Hindu tradition.
Mm.
The word tantra and sex are oxymoron.
Yeah.
You can't put them together in the same word. It just...
Yeah, because I've heard that there is something like that also in the tantric...
In the very highest level.
Yeah.
But it's extremely difficult. It's to do with using powerful energies.
Mm-hmm.
But to be able to do that is like...
You have to be really, really high.
Yeah. You have to be very... I mean, it's virtually impossible to do. Virtually impossible. But of course, Westerners hear about it and go, "Oh, that's for me."
Right.
It's just sex then. Come on. I mean, you know, again, it's just the spiritual ego, you know, putting a spiritual coat onto sex. And okay, but it's just sex.
Yeah.
Is it possible to find some details about Kriya, or it's still secret?
Again, generally, even here, you would only be introduced to these practices, historically at least, through your personal teacher. You know, you still need an empowerment and initiation to even practice this. So generally you'd only get that from your teacher when you're ready. Of course, nowadays, you know, there's empowerments everywhere and people go along and they go, "What was that all about?" And you've got no idea, so, yeah. Okay.
But if you find, like, a good yoga teacher, I mean, that you, like, rely on, so, I mean...
You good yoga teacher?
No, because when you say about Kriya Yoga is...
Oh, I mean, a good teacher... Well, they wouldn't introduce you to it until you... To practice Tantra,
yeah.
What's the basis? Three things.
Mm-hmm.
Renunciation, bodhicitta, and the wisdom of emptiness. We need those three.
Okay.
That's the basis for Tantra.
Okay.
At least at some experiential level. Fully developed, no, but we need to have really good experiential renunciation. We need to have quite well-developed bodhicitta experientially, and we need to have quite a good experience and taste of emptiness. If we have those, we have a basis. If we don't have, then Tantra is just a game,
mm-hmm,
and a game particularly that will, like going astray in mind training, will boost the ego. You know, often in this sort of sadhana practice here, that we do in this practice. You know, the first thing you do, you dissolve into emptiness and you arise as the deity.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, if we don't have those three things as a basis, then people go, "Okay, now I'm pretending to be Tara. Now I'm pretending to be Chenrezig." Completely miss the point. And then it just becomes an ego trip. "I'm Chenrezig. I'm Tara." And then it's just an ego trip. It's just spiritual ego. And it will become more delusional. So rather than Tantra helping us, it'll make it worse. So we don't want to practice this sort of practice unless we have a basis. Otherwise, we're just kidding ourselves. I mean, we're wasting our time and we're just strengthening the ego. We're really boosting the ego, you know, spiritual ego. I'm Tara, I'm Chen Resik. So instead of grasping as this is me, now we're just grasping onto Tara and Chen Resik as me. That's even worse. Even worse. Because then definitely we'll have an air of superiority over others. Because I'm Tara, I'm Chen Resik.
It's like I'm good.
Yeah, exactly.
But you still, I'm doing yoga, you know. I call it yoga because this is the way the Hindu tradition call it yoga.
Sure.
For me, it's also, I mean, I think it's also very healthy in a way, you know. It's like I feel better and I do it. So
but you're talking about physical asanas and that.
Yes,
I'm talking internal here.
Yeah, because the Kriya Yoga...
The Kriya, the external actions. Yeah, that's okay. But here I'm talking the internal practices.
Of course,
doing asanas and so forth, very helpful.
Yeah.
Working with the body, particularly the subtle body, can be very helpful.
Mm-hmm. I have a question about... I'm 100% against gossip, of course. But say you're at work and something is bothering you, like a person is bothering you, and not because of their action is bothering you, you know, just irrelative of it. But then you go back home, for example, and you talk to your partner about it and you criticize that person, but you don't mean to gossip about them, you just want to let it out. Is that something that you need to eliminate as well and deal with it on your own?
Well, of course, if you're not sure how to deal with it, and your partner may be able to give you some good advice about how to deal with it, because, you know, often we're sort of caught in the scene, so we're sort of emotionally, compromised. So if we, by talking to our partner, they can be a bit more objective about the situation and they can give us some useful advice about how to deal with it, that's fine. But just sort of getting it off our chest, just, you know, I mean, that's, of course, is not helpful.
Even if you're just criticising that person, really, he's not doing anything for you.
But again, criticising is cognitive fusion. We can be critical of their behaviour, but if we're criticising the person, we're doing cognitive fusion. So if we mentally or verbally do that, that's not helpful to anyone, less even ourselves, because we're just going to get caught up in this negativity.
So if you're consciously criticizing their behavior to your partner, that's it, then it's okay?
If your motivation is that by explaining this to your partner, somehow you can get some benefit in terms of it, get some advice from them. I mean, just venting it, of course, it's not going to help anything, is it? I mean, no.
Okay.
Because then you're probably going to get caught up in just churning around. Because remember, what we attend to becomes our reality. So if we keep attending to this, even if we don't do cognitive fusion, and we keep, that's what we see, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, people complain about, that they see a lot of negative things. And what are they focusing on is negative, you know. There's a nice expression that I like is, if you're a hammer, all you see is nails. No? That's true. And if you have a negative mind, all you see is negativity. And you'll be convinced everything's negative because that's your state of mind. And that's the filter you see everything with. So the more we generate that negative state of mind, of course, the more negativity we're going to see. Therefore, we need to focus on the positive, you know. Maybe we'll leave it there because it's time for lunch.